She waited for you. Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
Welcome to this meeting of the Economic Development and Planning Scrutiny Committee. And we will go straight away into minutes. Minutes of the 19th of August. Now, we've got a bit of a problem because there's scribbling all over the minutes, which is actually very serious notes that were made by Jackie. So we need to produce a second copy, a clean copy, which I'll sign later. Do you approve of that? Thank you very much. And we've got apologies.
Peter Jones substituted by Gareth Jones and Councillor Loughran substituted by Councillor Hobbs.
Thank you very much. Welcome both of you. Public question time, nil. Councillor session, nil. Members' items, nil. Called in items, nil. So we go straight to enforcement. And who's actually going to present on enforcement? I think there's going to be a double act. And will you both introduce yourselves for anybody who doesn't actually know you? I think that we're becoming a bit familiar with,
with both of you. Hi, I'm Lucy Gibbs. And I am working for a company called Mondrem, Community Interest Company, and we are here supporting the planning service through an improvement project, the DM service, sorry, through an improvement project.
Okay, and I'm Sushil Verdi, I'm the interim development manager at Stafford Council.
Can you hear at the back?
Yes.
Yes, good. Thank you very much, both of you, and I'll leave you to launch into it.
Okay, so just introducing the item. In terms of the team, the enforcement team consists of three officers. This is on the staff establishment, one senior enforcement officer and two enforcement officers to deal with caseload throughout the district. So we haven't at the moment got a full-time enforcement officer in any of our roles, so they've been vacant for a while. And you're probably aware that we've had agency enforcement officers in place for at least a couple of years, perhaps longer than that. Now, the report that's been sent around, it's an RTPR report back from 2010. So that highlights the number of difficulties that we're having within the enforcement area, particularly.
It's going to be one of those meetings.
You didn't do the thing about turning the mobile phones off, did
you? Oh, yeah, sorry. Can everybody turn their mobile phone off, or there's a serious risk of being fined and the money will go to charity, the mayor's charity? Carry on, Sushil.
Yeah, thank you. So, we know there's a national shortage of experienced enforcement officers. Every local authority in the country is going through this difficulty. There are authorities with full-time staff, they're very, very rare. So most authorities are relying on recruiting agency staff to cover the enforcement function. Now, some of the reasons for that, obviously it's a very, very lucrative agency market out there. So there are a number of agency officers that, well, the agencies that are holding on to enforcement officers, sending CVs around to get placements with local authorities. And when we do go to the market to recruit, we don't get a lot of interest. So it's recognised just what a difficult situation this is nationally. Just before I give you the report a second. So just in terms of the conclusions within the report, it highlights the pressure enforcement officers are under from obviously members and the general public, and obviously there's an expectation about the council taking forward enforcement activities. It also says that local councils find it impossible to attract candidates. We know that is the case, and the talent pool has been drained substantially. So councils are seen as being understaffed, insufficiently resourced, and I know also that leads on to the council being having difficulty in terms of taking direct action unless there is a strong political will to do that. So basically the words that he used are that the conditions within the enforcement area are desperate. And as I mentioned on the last line there, the agency market is basically creaming off enforcement officers into kind of short-term contracts. So as I mentioned, at the beginning of 2025, we had three agency planning officers, and they were coming towards the end of their contracts. Lucy McDonald, as you know, she was the enforcement officer at Cannock Chase, who I recruited back in 2022. So she began working at Stafford in January 2025. In April 2025, Lucy then got the team up to full strength and got three agency enforcement officers to work alongside her. Now Lucy has moved on now, so she doesn't work on the authority. So that was in September she departed. One enforcement officer left at the end of July, and recruitment has taken quite a while, and I've been able to recruit a replacement who started last week, but I've got another one who actually finishes today, so I'm back to being one enforcement officer down. Now, in the meantime, as we know, we've got, Lucy will touch on this, there is a backlog of cases to deal with. And whilst we've had two officers, the backlog has crept up, and that is also down to the holiday period as well, while some of the enforcement officers have taken periods of leave as well.
So I've just put together a bit of colour for you on the number of enforcement cases that are in the system, and you can see there that this is tracking open enforcement cases, and I've also put there, it's in the background, but you can see how many cases were opened each month and closed each month. So opened is those blue, the vertical, the bar graph, and the closed is the orange. So you can see it's not, some months you don't get very many complaints in, or the months you get a lot, and some months that you managed to close quite a few cases, especially when Lucy was here working with three enforcement officers. You can see in May, the only month that there was more cases closed than were opened there. And I've also given you an indicator of what healthy work in progress is. It's around about 100 cases, so that represents about 6 months worth of cases received. And having worked with multiple enforcement services, somewhere around 26 weeks worth of work in progress is what is normal and healthy for them to carry. So it's not that I've given you to is a horizontal line, but actually I just want you to think of it as more of an area. So it just shows you how far away you are from what would be a healthy volume of open cases to be carrying and investigating. We've outlined the staffing challenges. There is also challenges in terms of what becomes a case at the moment and what gets opened as a case. And this is a common challenge that I see across the country, in that scant enforcement resources must be directed at harmful and expedient cases. So the harmfulness is really important to try and outline and make it really clear what harm is. And you can actually score for harm, and we are working on, we released to you ahead of schedule, accidentally, the new enforcement policy that has a harm scoring framework in there. That's my fault, I'm really sorry. But it will come through very soon, so that you can focus the scant resources that you do have at the moment, and you know, more resources when you manage to hire for them, to looking at to investigating the harmful cases and then taking action on those that are expedient. And again, it's really important to be able to score for expediency. So that is, if we take action on this, would we follow it to its logical conclusion? There's very little point serving a notice if you're not going to then pursue it if somebody doesn't comply with it. You may or may not know that there is no criminal act committed in planning enforcement case until a notice has not been complied with. It feels like it should be a criminal act in lots of cases, but actually that's the point at which it does become, and then you do have to pursue it if that notice is not complied with. So it's about making sure that you all are arming those enforcement officers when you get them with a chance to be successful. In a very pressured market for staff, that's what the enforcement officers want to see. They want to go, you know, you will find it easier to recruit when you've got really robust policies that they know, because of their experience, have got a chance of being followed, and that they aren't. There is a different way to resolve planning enforcement breaches that don't score highly enough on the harmfulness scoring system to be able to be investigated in the first place. It's not to say they're not harmful to somebody somewhere, and it's probably somebody somewhere's, you know, real, it's really important to them, it's really affecting their life. And it's up to the council and the council's policies to come up with alternative ways that they can be dealt with. I'm not saying this is the case for Stafford, but in my experience, people will do almost anything to avoid talking to their neighbours. And actually, if you can put a community solution in place for the breaches that are being reported to you but are not harmful enough to direct your enforcement officers to go and investigate, if there's an alternative method for that, if there's a standard letter that you can put into a community group's hands to go and deliver to that person and have a conversation with them, that might be enough to get the breach resolved. So there are alternative methods. It's not saying if it's not high enough on the harmfulness scoring framework, don't do anything then. You're going to have to look at alternative methods of doing that that don't include directing your scant enforcement resources towards it. So that policy is coming through at the moment and will help, should help with your recruitment efforts, it should help with your retention efforts, and it should help them to deliver a good service in terms of investigating and taking action on the most harmful breaches.
Thank you.
I should have probably had that slide up when I was talking. Do you want to?
No, I was just going to quote a case I've got. A guy appealed the decision. The inspector refused the appeal. He made recommendations that this structure had to be removed within 30 days. It's been come back to enforcement, and someone went to see him, I don't know how long ago, but it's over 15 months now, and no action's been taken. The guy should have been taken to court because he's basically taking the pee out of our organisation. Sorry, I get quite heated about it.
I understand, it's a really emotive issue.
It's upset the row of houses behind. Basically what the guy did, he put a 20-foot container in his back garden, and then he built a wooden structure over it, a shed. He chopped down the hedge adjoining the properties and put up a fence on his the residents on the other side, and it goes on like that. You know, he's a builder, and he just thinks he knows everything, and he really wants his backside kicking, you know.
So the point with this one is that it went to the inspectors, and we're still not taking action.
But you'll deal with that. The enforcement went to the inspector, and the planning, I think, went to inspector, but he came back and said he made a recommendation in his refusal that the structure had to be removed within 30 days.
So the question there will be, does it become a priority? Does it go up the list rather than down the list, rather than in the interference?
I mean, an enforcement officer has gone, as I said, about a year after it came through. I think it was one of yours living in Kent or somewhere, but it's very frustrating, and I say for the residents, and the quite elderly, the people that live at the back of this thing.
Yeah.
I think I spoke to you about it before, Dean, actually.
Yeah.
I can't talk about specific cases myself, obviously, because I'm not involved in
it. I've followed up a couple of times, but it's back to the slide that was just shown. How much turnover have we had as temporary agency enforcement officers? And there's that loss of organisational memory.
Yeah.
We need you and I...
But one of the things, just keep reminding
officers that this actually, it should be a straightforward one.
It's chicken and egg. You need a robust team in place to be able to get a hit list together of these harmful breaches, and then.
Well, the main residents complain is
again
is not getting responses because it keeps chasing the council up again and again. and notifies me, then he's not getting a response.
Just respond to that, Chair. I think as I've moved into this role, obviously we're having to review the cases, and it's quite a substantial case load. So in instances like that where, you know, there's a clear decision to wait for the, you know, in the number of complaints around it, I mean, that was part of the harm assessment, you know, that would trigger further action. So I'll take that back. I'll speak to the team about it, and I think we need to assign priority on that basis.
Thank
you. I can amend that suggestion. What I did when we had someone else in your role was I compiled a list of about half a dozen, I think maybe 10 things that councillors have brought to me, and I chased the status of those, and that made it much simpler for the team to be able to say, well, these are the 10 cases, this is harmful, this is not harmful, this is what we're doing. That makes it a lot easier for you than running for one case and then the other. So, I mean, you're on my list, you were on last time, I'll compile that, I'll look at that list and add some more on.
I'm going to go to Brendan next.
Thank you, Chair. I wonder if there is a list of outstanding enforcement actions that can be filtered by ward?
We've got the data. I'm pretty sure it can be.
And to let that list be put out to ward members, so the ward members can have some input into how they perceive that enforcement to be serious or not serious or less serious, and just involve us, because if you've got limited resources, we can add into that without making the decision, but we can add some information into it.
Thank you. Dean.
For you, Jeff, thank you for that suggestion. I think, again, we'll take that away. I think there's two things there. There's the priority cases that Councillor Reid has mentioned, and again, if those can be collated, obviously sent through to Sushil. Sushil's obviously working to try and get the team up to full complement at the moment. We're working on the policy and the scoring. In terms of ward member, obviously we have to be mindful of sensitivities and, you know, that these cases are active enforcement cases, potential legal. So if it's okay with the committee, obviously we'll have a look at that and come back. I think in principle, yes, but we do need to review it in terms of and how we can share it.
Yeah.
So that's another one for us to take away, but I do understand what you're raising.
We are a resource.
Thank you. Doug.
I think in terms of like the discussion here is kind of that we have been is about how do we deal with the lower complement of resource. And I think what we've got in terms of like getting back to the necessary complement of resources is around the policy side of things coming in, and then there's a discussion of kind of recruiting people who maybe don't have the current experience and then delivering training quickly. Is there any other kind of levers that can be pulled in terms of improving recruitment? Is there anything? And I think on the other side of it, it's kind of notable the idea that there's such a lucrative environment for agencies. Is there something we can do in terms of putting pressure upwards to central government to ask them to do something about the fact that it's such a lucrative environment for agencies that they can regulate it more effectively to ensure part of it is that it's so much easier just to go elsewhere.
I read that biodiversity net gain even can't be enforced, and that I think is an issue that really should go up to government, because it would actually have some impact at political level. So I couldn't agree more on that point, but that's up to us as politicians, not up to the officers. So we need to get together and see what we could do.
Yeah. Are there other levers is the kind of question. The political one, yes, that's more of a comment to us.
Yeah. I think in the environment where we're operating in, some of the kind of feedback I'd about the enforcement function is that it relies on having basic quality staff. So if you've got good enforcement officers with you, your workers are to keep them there, but also having that stable team that's going to be there longer term. obviously we've got issue now with turnover, so there's going to be some drop off in terms of casework. But if I'm getting a team in and they're focused particularly on priority cases, but also bringing the backlog down, and that's purely their focus, we're really looking for people with a certain mindset to do that piece of work. Can't say the people that we've had previously were kind of recruited for that basis, but certainly what I'm doing now is to make sure that people coming in have got the expectation that, you know, this is how we want to work. There's some levers that we've just got in the last slide there in terms of delineating their kind of work priorities, and this protocol or enforcement policy that Lucy mentioned is about pulling all the priority cases, and those that aren't going to be taken forward or don't meet the harm assessment will just stop at the very early stages. So that again takes the pressure off the team to just pick up the cases that have got a high level of harm demonstrated.
There is, sorry, I didn't put my hand up before, I'm not used to
that. No, that's all right.
There is another lever that you can pull. Enforcement officers will come to work somewhere that they know there's adequate legal resources. Genuinely, if I was looking for a job and I could get a job anywhere I liked, and I was an enforcement officer, you know, that is what I would want. I would want you to set out that you will get to go to court, you will get to do the exciting stuff, you will get to build cases here. There is enough legal resource to actually progress stuff right the way through to the end. If you can make it exciting and not frustrating. So yes, you've got the policy about what's going to be investigated, how you're going to take, you know, you've got a really clear methodology there, you've got a really clear process, but also you've got a chance of getting to the end here and seeing direct action being taken or getting to that court date. You know, that's what a lot of enforcement officers
are going to reply to you.
Yeah.
Which begs the question, does Stafford Borough Council have a legal resource?
Well, I just was thinking that's a matter that we need to take to Cabinet.
I agree. And what you're hearing from Lucy in a number of different ways is there are other elements, other aspects of our community, antisocial behaviour, environment enforcement, legal. There's all sorts of ways in which these departments support each other and enable us to do what our residents need. That's what we need, and we need to make sure that we budget for that, we plan for that, we recruit to that. I'm sure local government reform is going to complicate that as well, but and I've been saying to my officers for quite a while now, I want our enforcement team to be something that shows it is worthwhile being an officer here, it's worthwhile getting your job here, because we are people that take it seriously from community projects, antisocial, and planning enforcement.
And we have a legal team that's capable of
and we do have a legal
undertaking
team
that's
capable of doing that, and the prioritisation that
sure
Lucy and Sushi are talking about is all part of that as well, because while we've got a legal team, they can do so much, and we need to figure out how they support and how they can get success.
Has anybody got any particular comments on this slide that Lucy and Sushi have put up? That's the way it's going.
So can I just ask, if you're recruiting an enforcement officer, what sort of background do you expect them to be? Would they be in existing planning departments, or
a well-trodden route is an ex-police officer?
Yes,
ex-police officer.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Very, very, very common amongst the.
We have an ex-enforcement officer in our midst, actually. I'm not sure she came through the policing route.
So, Chair, one important part there is that the ex-policing officer route is very well trodden as long as the team is embedded within the planning team, so that expertise on both sides can be shared. Because you need to know not just what you're doing, but how you're doing it and what might happen as a result. So, and that is our structure, that's what we've got. And we can look at enforcement as a whole as well, because as Lucy said, a number of the solutions aren't necessarily planning enforcement, community solutions, antisocial, and police enforcement are sometimes things that change what we do. But yeah, that's a great way of recruiting.
Dean?
Hey, yeah, thank you, Chair. In terms of some of the points that have been raised, obviously, enforcement policy, enforcement team, we need to have a team. So the legal resource capacity is absolutely correct. We do have capacity challenges in our legal services team. Obviously, I'm not head of service for that area, but obviously we work very closely with the team, and it's very equally challenging to get solicitors into the authority. Again, similar issues in terms of recruitment, competition. We do have some really good officers in the legal services team, and we work very closely with them. And we just need more of them and the ability to get more into the team. So I don't want to kind of detract from the work that they do, because, as I say, there's some really good people there. And there are some very, very challenging cases, which I'm not going to talk about individual cases, but that we are working on at the moment. And the support that we've had from legal has been excellent. So I want that message to be heard, really. But, you know, clearly that is a resource challenge in legal. But yeah, in terms of the background, I think that's been covered. A variety of different backgrounds. I think the RTPI report again talks about some of the challenges there. It's not seen generally as an attractive enough career option for young people, for graduates. Clearly, the RTPI as the professional body has a role to play in promoting that. So it's not seen as the kind of correlation here. You know, people want to be planning officers, development management. It's obviously there's a really clear career path there. And we, as we've said previously, we've got a really good track record of training people and supporting them. Planning enforcement, less so. And it's difficult to retain people. But the other point as well is that obviously it's not statutory, and I think that's kind of not always acknowledged. It is a discretionary service. There is a role there to play, perhaps, in terms of lobbying. And, you know, planning development management is a statutory function, and we have to do it. Enforcement, you know, it is discretionary, but it is really important. And we don't generate fees or income, and whereas with development management we do have income coming to the authority, which we can invest in additional resource when we have particular pressures. So there's a number of things in there, really, but it's a challenging environment.
Thank you.
Is there a problem with the Mike's staff at Borough Council against other Borough Councils with the wage structure? Is that one of the reasons why the leaverness? Not the wage structure.
I think picking up on your point around the agencies, you know, the what they're being paid as agency staff.
Yeah, it's far more than normal.
We wouldn't be able to compete with that even if we looked to uplift some of the current roles. It's far higher. And I think some of the things that we would usually expect people to be attracted to, you know, in terms of job security, local government pension, all that sort of stuff, perhaps is less important. People are attracted to the higher rates of pay and the fact that they can move around and take different contracts, 6 months at one council, 12 months at another. So I think social, that's our experience, isn't it? That people are quite flexible to move around, and obviously we've got working from home as well, so they can be based anywhere.
Okay.
If I just add to that as well, I mean, there are instances of the market being so attractive that a lot of contractors won't see out their contract. You know, they get offers from elsewhere, and you know, they can move on quite quickly. They're kind of not experienced as minimal as well.
Okay.
Have you thought about a postgrad apprenticeship for that? Because I mean, it's been on the press or in the press recently about how many postgraduates can't get jobs because there's no openings. So that would perhaps be an ideal, where, and particularly if they, you know, the apprenticeship, say for 2 years or whatever it takes to train somebody up, I don't know, then they have to give that time back as well, their contract, or they have to pay that, and with already having graduate fees in their back pocket to pay back. So, you know, that sort of thing, what would that be an idea to?
For you, Chair, it's one of the things that we're looking at. So, I mean, again, if we're able to grow our own kind of resource, we need somebody kind of you know, qualified and experienced to bring them through. So that would be an issue, but I wouldn't close the door on it. I'll definitely look at the possibility of doing that.
It
may be, yeah, maybe the only option going forward.
Yeah. Do it very well in the planning department.
Yeah.
Brought on all sorts of people through the planning service. And the other, if there's no other things on that, I just wonder if you might just mention the unauthorised encampments, because they've been a big, big problem in the borough. I know that we are not to talk about any particular individual current case, but the Gypsy and Traveller community seem to have rights over and above the normal planning process, which makes it very difficult to enforce, as I understand it. Can you just comment on it? Because we've had an awful lot of them happening.
I mean, I don't know the background to all of the cases. I mean, there are kind of implications in terms of the Equality Act, which we need to take into account.
Yeah.
But in terms of the enforced investigation, it would follow the same route in terms of what the breach is, and then make an assessment of that breach and what further action is required. As I say, there's more kind of focus on the Equality Act as well.
It'd be interesting to know what level it would reach in the sort of hierarchy of serious cases.
Mm.
It shouldn't be the top.
Sorry?
Sorry, just
yeah.
Talk to myself.
Anyway, any other points that people want to make on enforcement?
If I can just wrap up a little.
No, I don't want you to wrap up, thank you. You're the cabinet member.
one comment then, going forward, are we sometimes making a rod for our own back by having the conditions on planning approval? So we list all these conditions, and we probably know that 50% of them are not enforceable.
Yeah.
So are we probably needing, from a planning point of view, to say, here are the conditions we would like. However, these are the conditions that won't work, and they're not part of the approval.
It's a good, very good point.
Yeah, I can come back on that one, actually, because we've just been having a discussion on conditions this morning. So the Planning Inspectorate have released a list of standard planning conditions that meet the six tests to make sure that they are enforceable, basically, and we are looking at not restricting, but cutting down the number of conditions and certainly standardising them with the DM team, so that not only are they all theoretically at least enforceable, but there's less of a raft to sort of pick from. So you've got, you know, you're applying them only when you really need to, which is what the Planning Inspectorate set out. So yeah, that is a piece of work that's ongoing at the moment.
Because we're just setting ourselves up
yeah.
to fall, aren't we, if we've got 25 different conditions mm-hmm. and only five are enforceable.
Yeah.
So that's an action that is being undertaken already, so the minutes will record that. We've got the actions that we want to take through to Cabinet.
Is there a plan, Chairman, to bring the 400 cases down to the 100 that was mentioned in the previous slide? And is there a timetable to
that?
Good
question.
Or is it all dependent on recruitment?
Chair, yes, it's difficult to put a time frame to it, because it is dependent on having the staff in place to work their way through the backlog. Now there are some tricky cases in there, and there's others that, you know, we could potentially start to feed out of the process. I think I think it's about 380 we've got cases at the moment. So we haven't got a handle on just how much of those cases are going to go forward. So we need to do that review, and this is where the enforcement policy is going to help us to do that, because that will set the parameters where we're going to assess the schemes, and from that process we're expecting quite a number will then fall away, and we'll get back to the complainant and say these aren't cases that we can take forward. So the number will come down, but then within that, what's left over, we'll then need to kind of assess those and prioritise those going forward. So I think if once we're in the point where we've got the policy adopted, and we start to apply it, then I'll be able to come back and give you a more kind of accurate figure in terms of what the backlog is, what the timetable is later.
Thank you, Dean.
Thanks, Joe. So I think in terms of the plan, the immediate priority is to fill all of the agency enforcement officer posts, which Sushil is progressing. That's the immediate priority. To then look at the cases that need urgent action. So clearly we will do that immediate review. The enforcement policy, as Lucy alluded to, we have a draft which we're just working up into a final version, which will then go to Cabinet for formal approval. We hope to do that by the end of this year. We also be looking to go out and recruit the vacant roles as well. So again, we're just working through job descriptions, looking at how they are graded. Are we paying enough in light of other local authorities? So that is an exercise we're doing with HR colleagues at the moment. The proviso there is we go out, there's no guarantee we'll fill any of the posts, but if we can fill one, I think I'd be pleased. But if we can fill some of those and get permanent staff in who are obviously committed to the authority and want to a career here, that would be our preference. So the team will then look to start doing the kind of triage of the cases using the new policy and scoring. We've got some ideas as well about how they can manage that workload. And I would suggest we'll come back to the committee in probably March, Chair, just to give you a bit of an update. Won't be the final product, be very much a work in progress, but we can show you where we are in terms of all of those areas, and hopefully we're starting to make some progress in bringing those numbers down. So that answers your question, but
thank you.
March, we'll come back.
I think that people happy with that we bring it back in March.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, we might have a volunteer to lead on the approach to government to change the enforcement law so that it becomes a mandatory requirement on local authorities. And no doubt will tell us what Cabinet's going to take out of it.
Now or in March?
No, now. What was the action out of Cabinet immediately?
I just need to find it.
Yeah, I'll put you on the spot.
You wanted to write about the NG not being enforceable.
Yes, that will go to government as well. What we're asking is that Cabinet takes forward this issue of the biodiversity net gain not being enforceable, because that seems a completely ludicrous situation.
So as I understand, the national situation is a national shortage of ecology officers who are able to enforce biodiversity net gain. I don't believe Stafford Council has that same problem. We have an ecology officer, we have a plan, and we do have a way of putting programmes together and enforcing it. I will work with officers to make sure that is as robust as we can, but there are some national policies there that really do help us. We are in a better position than a lot of
So it'd be useful to bring that back in March as well as part of it, if that would be okay.
We can talk about successes. And where my officers talk about challenging cases, I'd like the press to pick up on the fact that means interesting cases. So if you are thinking of working for an authority, we've got a diverse range of cases, a diverse range of situations. And we're really eager, we've got the right policies, the team put into place. It's a really good place to work, to gain experience and to be a team lead as well.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair.
You've got the last word.
The last word, okay.
You've got the second last word. And then I'm going to wrap up.
I remember one of the last planning meetings that I chaired, we were talking about biodiversity net gain, and this particular development is only going to deliver 1% as opposed to the target 10%. And the conversation was going around biodiversity net gain. All I could see was a sea of faces who were absolutely clueless what was going on, because no one could understand what 1% was as compared to 10%, how it can be delivered. And I thought at the time, we possibly as councillors might benefit from some sort of workshop on good. What is bio
definitely.
And how is it achieved?
An update. I think there was one actually.
Yeah, I think
there
was one.
But
a refresher
would be
yeah.
very helpful.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Brian, last
yeah,
one.
Just a question. Lucy mentioned police officers are good. So, do we actually advertise through to the police department of the possibility of
yeah.
an avenue that they could take a second career?
I've never seen anybody go direct to. I don't even know if there's a policing magazine or anything. I've no contacts whatsoever in the police. Sorry, I can't answer that one.
We'll ask you. We'll ask you to pick that one up as well, Sushil.
I do see some ex-police officers' CVs coming through from agencies.
Okay. Well, we pass that on to you. I'm moving on now to the next item, and thank you for that contribution. Oh, you haven't finished your presentation. That's shocking. Perhaps you better send it to us, Lucy.
Have you not got the presentation then?
I can. Yeah, and then we can see what the last part of it was.
Yeah.
Sorry about that. The next item is quarter one performance. Now, the thing with quarter one performance is it doesn't really tell us very much, because it's a backward look at figures, and we're only partway through the year, so take it with a bit of caution, I think. Who's leading on this one? Dean.
Yeah, thanks, Chair, for the introduction. So, yeah, it's quarter one, it's the end of June. In terms of the prosperous economy priority delivery plan for 25-26, we have 19 projects. 16 of those projects or actions are actually not due yet, so we will be providing reports on those in later quarters. We did complete 3 actions in the first quarter. Pleased to report, I'm sure you're all aware, that we completed work on the Station Approach project, which was funded by the Future High Street Fund grant monies and part of the town centre transformation. So work on that completed in May. I think feedback has been positive. Hopefully you'll agree the work looks great. And as I say, we'll be... We're moving obviously on to other phases of the project, and further updates will come back in subsequent quarters. In terms of the other projects or actions that are completed, the UK Reef 2025 event was in May. Officers attended the event with the leader of the council, and we promoted our town centre development prospectus, which highlighted the scale of the opportunity that's been created in Stafford Town Centre. Obviously you're aware we've acquired the Guildhall Shopping Centre, the Co-op, and we put forward our initial ideas around the redevelopment of those sites. We had lots of very valuable meetings with national developers, operators, who were very interested and excited about the regeneration opportunities in Stafford Town Centre. So we've obviously attended the event, that action is complete, but we've had further meetings with those developers and operators, and there's about 12 in total that we've met over the summer, and we're working now on a further report which will come back to Cabinet with a development framework, which will be a much more detailed version of the document that we presented at UK Reef. So again, more I can say about that, Chair, at the next meeting, but UK Reef was really successful, and we were part of a kind of wider Staffordshire team, lots of really, really good conversations. The other action that's complete, UK Shared Prosperity Fund, we received a further allocation of monies for 25-26. I think, as we've said at previous meetings, we spent all of our money through the 22-25 programme. Michelle, remind me how much we've had in 25-26?
It's just shy of £1.5 million.
£1.5 million. So we took a report to Cabinet back in July. We got agreement to suite of projects which will be funded by UKSBF, and things obviously have already moved on, Chair, because we're well on it in terms of moving those projects forward. And again, more than happy to bring updates back to a further future meeting if that would be helpful. So I think that's it in terms of the updates to the, on the projects. Obviously, you've got the key performance indicators as well, and we update in terms of performance on planning. Some of the regeneration indicators there, we're not able to include data at this point because it's data which is released on an annual basis. But in terms of major applications and non-major planning applications, you can see the quarter one performance there, which is in line or above the targets which are set by government. And in terms of appeals, we didn't have any major or non-major appeals determined in the period. So, happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much. Anybody got...
We don't seem to be having planning meetings like we used to. Is that because there aren't planning applications coming through, or we've changed our policy, or what?
Well, I'll start. But yeah, through your chair, yeah. We are having plenty of planning applications coming through, so I think it's probably just scheduling of the committee.
I should have said callings.
Callings.
Yeah, I think at the last for the last couple of meetings that have been cancelled, it's been where call-ins have been withdrawn once a report's been written with a recommendation. So it's not that things aren't being called in, they are, but then when the report's drafted, the member that called it in is given the option to withdraw, and they have been.
Yeah, they've got the answer they want.
There's plenty of applications coming in.
Thank you. No more questions. We just received that report, I think. Happy with that? Then we've got the gateway update. That'll be you, Michelle, presumably.
It is. So I guess there's kind of three bits to update on this. One is the overall position with levelling up funding, which is what sits underneath our Scottish Gateway project. So the council were awarded round three levelling up fund money, which was under the previous government. So there was an announcement nearly a month ago now that the government had a local regeneration fund, and basically what that's done is it's scooped up the various different strands of funding, so levelling up fund, towns fund, town deals, not future high streets because in theory those are pretty much done, but basically it's now the local regeneration fund. So if we start talking to you about that rather than levelling up, it's the same thing. So that came through. There's been a relaxation in the monitoring requirements for that fund, which I don't think anyone has shed a tear over because it's quite a significant piece of work. So we don't need to do a performance return to government until next April. On the Borough Council side of things, there's not a huge amount I can say because I think last time I updated that we are progressing our land acquisition. So whilst that's still in legals, I'll just leave that there. Only to say that as the kind of lead authority, as opposed to the County Council on this project, we're setting up the board meeting, which as with any meeting with lots of people from multiple organisations is somewhat tricky to get a date in the diaries, but I promise you people are working very hard to try and get that date in, so it's not been forgotten, it's just tricky. The third strand is on the County Council's work stream. So they have been continuing to do their initial ground investigations works, but also you'll have seen that there has, I think, some fencing's gone up around what was the Chevron garage site. So the business is being relocated by the County Council. There will be an application for permission to demolish the buildings that are currently on site. The fencing is basically just a security measure in the interim, so it's not that anyone's going to come and do anything without permission, it's purely just to secure the land. So once we have details of that application, which I'm told are imminent, we can share that with you. So all on track, but just not a very exciting part.
It's a good expression, on track, isn't it, in the circumstance? And talking of on track, the Network Rail is on track as well, presumably.
Yes, so Network Rail are involved in a specific area of the project, which actually sits outside of the funding element of the work, which is to do with works connected to the actual station. it's complicated because Network Rail is complicated, the way that their structure is set up, and you have to have sponsors for things, and then the sponsors have to take things through internal boards. But that piece of work is progressing nicely.
Okay. Doug?
The land investigation work.
Yes.
What's the timeline for completion on that? Is there any information we have?
There's nothing I can share as yet. Effectively, what we're doing, the County Council have commissioned the work because it's on their land. Because they are doing that work under the umbrella of the funding that we're the responsible body for, the Borough Council are in the process of appointing somebody who understands the data that's being pulled together, because I certainly don't, who will basically translate it for us. So I think once we're at a point that we've got something meaningful to share, absolutely we'll do that.
Thanks. Anybody else? Any?
Where is the Chevron garage? Is it the old Citroën garage?
No, it's what used to be the Universal like in-house garage. So when you go down Doxy Road, the factory was on the one side,
Okay.
It was on the other.
And any comment on the post office issues? No issues with them at all. That's fine. Anything else?
No.
We move on. Thank you very much, Michelle. That's very helpful, and we'll keep getting updates from you as required. Now we come to renewable energy, which is the next big topic of the evening, or hopefully the last big topic of the evening. Pages 38 to 49 for those who want to look at the thing. Who's leading on? Oh, right, far away.
So obviously before you, you've got a report which is setting out the national and local policies relating to renewable energy, because obviously we have been having a number of applications coming forward, mainly for solar farm arrays. The paper basically sets out the NPPF position, the current adopted local plan position, and then you will have examples of planning appeals that have both been allowed and dismissed, which are broken down into three themes, which is overplanting, best most versatile land, and landscaping heritage. The point of providing the two examples was to show that actually it's really difficult to say, if you have an application on this type of land doing this, this, and this, you can refuse it. Because as you can see, one appeal will be allowed on heritage and landscape grounds, and it will be dismissed on another. And this is because each site is unique. We then set out the local plan evidence base that we began to develop as part of the new emerging local plan 2020-2040, which is obviously now stopped. But that information is still worthwhile, it's still relevant. We can still use it as part of our planning application process. And then basically, we then move on to sort of say, this is what our development management officers, who are obviously the people who are dealing with the applications, are sort of saying they need as part of the evidence base going further. So I'm happy to take any questions.
Anybody want to?
Yeah, we
Anne.
Thank you.
Anne first, Doug next. You first.
Oh, thank you. Have we got a strategy for the sort of connectivity and battery storage, particularly for like small villages and towns, because we're generating all this electricity, it needs to be stored, because obviously if it's a really good day, everybody's generating it. So have got a strategy for that?
We don't personally as a borough council have that strategy. Obviously Western Power have their own remit, and they sort of know where there's capacity issues, where things can happen. It is a bit of a first come, first serve situation. I do believe that on a county level, discussions are happening about battery storage, etc., but it's not something we are leading.
Thanks. Doug?
Sort of alluded to in the report, but is the number of applications we're receiving higher than other places, or is it the same as other places? Is it an increase generally that we're just experiencing part of?
It's an increase across the country, especially since the thresholds have changed from 50 megawatts to 100 megawatts under this new government. It's just an increase as you know, renewable energy is a more eco-friendly way of producing power.
Yeah, there are, sorry Chair, there was to say there are lots of examples of this in other parts of the country. So obviously Jenny, you've listed some examples in the paper, and obviously there's some notable ones elsewhere, but yeah, we're not alone on this. You know, we know there is a national it's a topical issue.
What looks so illogical is that an application will be refused or an application will be permitted, and they, on the face of it, they look very similar in planning terms. I mean, we've got two in my ward. One's been refused, one was permitted. I thought it'd be the other way around. So the whole thing seems very illogical at the moment. Brendan.
Thank you. I'm looking at page 40. 5.7, well, it must be E, in areas where other renewable energy schemes are in operation, the cumulative effect of additional developments will be an important factor. How do we measure the cumulative effect? Do we have some sort of, well, if it's the same size as the one over the road or whatever, then that's too much, or if it's only half the size, that's okay. How do we measure that?
So there isn't a numerical measurement, unfortunately, which would make life much easier for all officers, because obviously it will always differ. And that's where you get into the expert advice and expert experience in terms of the impact on landscape, because certain landscapes can take more because of how they are than other ones. So you might have a 50 megawatt plus a 20 megawatt in one location and go, know the cumulative effect in that location alone is too much, but move it somewhere else and it might be okay. So unfortunately we don't have a if this, this and this, then it's too much. And that's why we do need the expert advice and the evidence base to grow, to sort of take in those sort of considerations. But we are having discussions about what can we add to this local policy? Is there anything we can do to sort of beef it up a bit?
And the cumulative effect, I mean, again, I'm using a personal experience here, but the cumulative effect on a single parish is that practically the whole parish is going to be taken up with the solar farm. Well,
yeah,
that must be one aspect of cumulative effect,
yeah,
that should be part of a policy that we have within the Borough Council. So my next question is, when's our policy coming out?
Well, as you know, the local plan process is in a little bit of upheaval.
Flux.
And we are working at pre-scoping information. We can't officially launch work on the new plan, the 2025 to 2045 plan, but we are looking what engagement we can do now, what evidence base can we begin to develop. We are in the process of commissioning evidence base for climate change, of which renewable energy will be part of that piece of work. So it is coming forward. In terms of when I can exactly say this is when you will have a new policy, can't answer that because we haven't yet got the full details from National in terms of how to make a new local plan, unfortunately.
And we can't have a separate policy of our own?
No, unfortunately not.
Right. Frank?
Have we got many extra planning applications coming for solar panels?
Not a lot.
As in, on houses?
Yeah, no, on
the big solar array.
Because the farming community at the moment, everybody tells me, is in a disaster situation. And this is the one where you're getting money back.
Doesn't Appendix 1 show where the solar cells are?
These are the approved ones. I think we've got...
They're all approved, are they?
Two.
Yeah.
There's two current applications in for solar park, no?
No, I think it's going over there.
Sorry?
I think there's 11. There's four in my ward alone.
Yeah, and there's two in mine. One going through.
Yeah. Bear in mind that some of the screening rather than full applications.
No, these are full.
No, and ours is full.
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry.
Okay. Well, I don't have the exact numbers in front of me in terms of how many live applications we've got currently. What's referred to in Appendix 1 are the ones that have been approved. And if you look at paragraph 1-2, that says what is currently being approved and how much the combined total of those six approved applications generates for the area.
What page is that, please?
It's page 41.
Thank you.
Paragraph 5.12.
The question remains, I suppose, how does the planning authority refuse any of these applications because there are basically no grounds to refuse them unless there's a major highways argument?
I'm not going to lie, it is difficult. However, the appeals do show that we can try and refuse. What we have to do is use the policies we've got in our adopted plan. We have landscape policies, we have landscape area policies. We do have, as you can see at the end of the renewable energy policy, the sort of cumulative effect, and it's how we use them as best possible, and the existing evidence base that we've already collated and anything that we collate going forward. So I would strongly say it's not a case that we can't refuse, it's just we can't say we will definitely win that refusal if it goes to appeal.
We remain to be convinced.
It's often hard to see a benefit to local government reform, but one of the benefits will be the strategic body that takes over spatial policies, especially around the battery storage that Councillor Walker came up with, and the best places for grid connectivity, local and national grid, things like that. Combined authorities, those areas, have got quite strong policies in these, where they're established, city regions the same. We currently don't have that, and that mechanism is shared between some of the central government, some of the county, and it's in flux. So maybe one of the few benefits of local government reorganisation in the medium to long term will be clearer direction on that, and some level of democratic decision about where those installations, where that infrastructure should be. And without that infrastructure, we're not going to have successful renewable energy, and we're not going to have clear plans that minimise cumulative impacts and things. That will help our planning, and that will help our communities. There's not a lot more to say other than spatial policies are a good thing, and it's nice that they're in local government control rather than central government diktat.
Well, we've all been there before with the regional government, with I remember Advantage West Midlands and the government, Birmingham-based regional government. We go around in circles. The problem we've got with solar farms is the difficulty of actually objecting to them, except where there isn't access to the national grid. It's going to be more difficult because local authorities are not going to have the powers to deal with the applications as they get bigger and bigger. They'll all be dictated by central government. The other problem we have is that it requires best and most versatile land to be protected. Well, in Staffordshire, we don't have best and most versatile land except in small pockets, because we don't generally have grade 1 and 2 land in this county. So all our grade 3 C land, which is most of our grassland, is going to be under challenge for transformation to solar farms. It's a problem for the local authority as to how we deal with it, because we have no powers at the moment. And we will deal with everyone on its merits, but it's extremely difficult, I think. And that's my personal thoughts, as somebody's dealing with my third right now.
Is it not a wider part of the general industrialisation of the countryside?
Absolutely.
They're directly linked to the very large dairies to polytunnels, pump houses, and so there's kind of aspects to it which are specific to this. I think that kind of there's some noise elements to it and those types of things, but I think that there's a it's a different kind of farming. It's a different kind of farming. I think there's a business decision to for the borough to support for farms which are finding it difficult to make money in other ways, and they need to move to this.
So long as we can produce our own food for the nation.
I think in the long term, I'm concerned that we're not going to be able to produce that food, but I think that that's more due to the collapse of the Gulf Stream than it is due to to not having enough land.
We might be growing pineapples instead of eggs and milk.
The opposite is the case.
Okay.
We'll be in normal Canada climate, not...
We'll be,
Chair, I'm not sure this committee can do much about the North Atlantic group.
I think it's worth mentioning.
Anybody got any farming
in this country.
Any more comments on this particular item? We note it. I don't think there's anything that particularly we want to come out of it.
On that appendix one, are we worried that there's not enough applications there, or are we concerned that there's too many, or?
So appendix one is just showing the ones that have been approved to date. It's not showing
the total of those comes to something like 380 megawatts. Mm. Is that something that we want, or is it too much, or what?
Obviously, there is a national push to generate, you know, electricity power via renewable energy means. There isn't a set target. The question of if it's too much or not enough, that's something we can investigate as part of the evidence base for the emerging local plan, and it's something we've asked our climate change consultants when we hire them. It was part of the tendering document to look at, you know, those sort of wide spatial issues.
It's the point that I'm making, really, that how much proportion of our farmland do we want to pass over to energy production and in all its forms. So no doubt the local plan will have a look at that. Thank you, everyone. Thank you very much, Jenny, for your presentation and answering all the questions. Sorry? Oh, you're going here. And we now move on to the work programme. Page 50 to 54. We got all the stuff at the beginning, which you have read. And taking you to the appendix on page 53, the proposal is for Thursday, the 18th of December. Oh, made a bit of an amendment on this. I'm suggesting is that we have an update on the NPPF and strategic plan. Dean, what are we going to bring into that?
So Alex and Sasha
will
work together and just bring you an update note on the latest position on planning policy, particularly the NPPF. Other changes that are being proposed by the government around planning reform. So not quite sure what will be in the note at the moment, but no doubt my colleagues will have further information to update on. But there is obviously you're aware there's a raft of things happening nationally around planning reform. I think it's important that the committee are aware of those developments. So we probably expect by December I'll have an updated position on.
You're happy with that?
Yeah.
Okay, and then we've got the master plan, including parking strategy in there, historic buildings, conservation areas, and then this thing called cumulative impact assessment, and I asked what that meant, and it all goes back to regulatory services. Jackie's an expert on this.
So we were going to look at evening, nighttime economy.
Well, that's what I'm getting at, yes.
Cumulative impact assessment feeds into that. So I have been in touch with the head of regulatory services to see if she can give us a bit of an update as part of your wider.
Okay. So that item will become the evening and nighttime economy. So we'll have a dig at how that's performing across the three towns of Eccleshall, Stafford and Stone, I think would be helpful. And then section 106, is that the 18th of December now? Or is that
no,
going to push back?
We're taking it out.
We're taking
we're
it out.
Joint.
Yeah, we're going to have a joint section 106 with resources, because otherwise we're both tackling the same item. So what I'm proposing is that we have one meeting in the year when we have a joint meeting to discuss section 106. Otherwise, they keep it on their quarterly agenda just to make sure that the monies are coming in, basically. Are we happy with that? Okay. And then we go forward to the 19th of March. We're putting enforcement policy back on, otherwise that's as is. Add to it if you want. And then we've got future items at the back. Anybody want to add anything else to it? It seems like we've got quite a lot to discuss. If not, I close the meeting. Thank everybody for your attendance and look forward to seeing you at the next one.